Welcome, dear listener, to a brand new deep dive. You're listening to Physical Chemistry Fundamentals,
the place where we break down electrochemistry.
We look at applications,
yeah,
hands-on examples, you know, for everyday understanding.
And today, it's a big one.
Yeah, today we're plunging into a topic that, well, it literally shapes our modern world. Electrochemical deposition.
It sounds complex, maybe a little intimidating.
It can.
But you've definitely encountered it. Maybe seeing that bright shine of copper plating back in a school chemistry class.
Or just the finish on like a Christmas ornament, right?
Exactly. Or the mirror surface on, well, lots of things. It's fascinating how this process, which you can see so easily sometimes, underpins so much technology.
Absolutely. So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the different types of electrochemical deposition. We'll go from the basics,
the fundamentals,
right up to the really sophisticated techniques used in, you know, high-tech industries.
We'll look at the how and the why, how these precise layers get built up.
So what does this all mean for us today? Let's get started. Okay, let's unpack this. Electrochemical material deposition, sometimes called galvanic deposition.
Right.
Fundamentally, it's about reducing dissolved metal ions, taking them out of a solution.
And plating them onto an electrode, or a substrate, as we call it.
And you do this using an external voltage source.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like building a new layer, atom by atom, very precisely.
That's a good way to put it. But it's not just the electron transfer. You know, microscopically, it's quite a sequence.
Oh.
Yeah. First, the metal ions, they have to shed their solvent molecules. That's called desolvation.
Okay. Lose their little water jackets.
Kind of, yeah. Then they absorb onto the surface,
yeah,
but they're not fully neutral yet. They're sort of partially discharged ions. We call them adatoms.
Adatoms. Got it.
And these adatoms, they diffuse across the surface. They move around until they find a good spot, like a step edge on the crystal structure.
Oh, like a kinksite.
Exactly. And
yeah,
there, they finally integrate properly into the metal lattice. It's quite the journey for each atom.
And this isn't just, you know, theoretical or for lab demos anymore.
Not at all. Huge economic significance.
Right. Many raw materials, think aluminum, think copper, they're refined or extracted electrochemically on a massive scale.
And then there are the coatings. Decorative coatings, sure, but also really important ones.
Like for corrosion resistance, that's huge.
Absolutely. And functional structures in electronics, the precision is key there.
And the efficiency is incredible, isn't it? You mentioned almost all the material ends up in the product.
It's very efficient in that sense. Very little waste compared to some other methods.
But it's not as simple as it looks in those school experiments.
Oh, definitely not. You might expect it to be straightforward, but the reality is much more intricate.
Why is that?
Because you've got all those processes happening at once. Adsorption, surface diffusion, forming those initial stable nuclei on a foreign substrate.
Right. Getting that first layer to stick properly.
Yeah. Exactly. And honestly, much of this field developed empirically, sort of trial and error since the mid-19th century. We're still figuring out all the details.
Okay, so we know the basics. Let's dive into the different methods. How do we actually do this deposition? First up, the classic, galvanic deposition.
The workhorse. This is where you directly reduce those dissolved metal ions onto your substrate, which is connected to an external power source, your standard electroplating setup.
And you mentioned challenges. Especially with certain metals.
Yes, particularly with less noble metals, ones that are more reactive. You often get a side reaction happening.
Uh-huh.
The hydrogen evolution reaction, or HAR, water splitting to make hydrogen gas.
And that's bad because?
Well, two reasons mainly. One, it lowers your current efficiency. You're wasting electricity making hydrogen instead of depositing your metal.
Oh.
And two, that hydrogen can actually get incorporated into the metal coating. That can lead to something called hydrogen embrittlement, making the coating brittle.
Not good. So how do you avoid that?
Sometimes you can switch to different electrolytes, molten salts, or maybe organic solutions where there isn't water to cause the HER.
Clever.
Or you can deposit alloys, mixtures of metals, or even composite layers embedding tiny hard particles like aluminum oxide or silicon carbide into the metal as it grows. Makes it tougher.
Interesting. Okay, method two, immersion deposition. Or immersion plating.
Mm-hmm.
How's that different?
This one's neat because it's self-limiting.
Self-limiting, yeah.
You take your workpiece made of a less noble metal and dip it into a solution containing ions of a more noble metal.
Okay.
An exchange happens. The more noble metal deposits onto the workpiece surface.
Right.
And an equivalent amount of the less noble metal from the workpiece dissolves into the solution.
A direct swap, like zinc and copper sulfate.
Perfect example. Copper plates onto the zinc. But once the zinc is covered by copper, the reaction stops. because the less noble metal isn't exposed anymore.
So it only forms a thin layer.
Exactly. Often used as a pre-treatment step, like putting down a base layer before doing something else.
Makes sense. Okay, third one, autocatalytic deposition, also called electrolysis. This sounds different again. No external current.
That's the key distinction. No external power supply, no counter electrode needed.
So how does the reduction happen? Magic.
Huh, not quite. You use a chemical reducing agent that's dissolved right there in the electrolyte solution.
Okay.
But here's the clever part. The solution is designed so the reaction doesn't happen readily in the bulk liquid. It's inhibited there.
But it happens on the surface.
Precisely. It only proceeds rapidly on a catalytically active surface. Often you'll seed the surface with tiny particles, like palladium nuclei.
So the surface itself kicks off the reaction and activates it.
Exactly. Yeah. The surface acts as the catalyst. This is incredibly important for putting metal layers on things that don't conduct electricity.
Like plastics. Or circuit boards.
Yes. Making those copper traces on printed circuit boards. Or putting shiny decorative coatings on plastic parts.
How does that work in practice?
Usually several steps. You activate the surface, maybe adsorb some tin ions, then use immersion deposition to form those palladium nuclei seeds.
Okay, the catalyst seeds.
Then you put it in the autocatalytic bath. The palladium starts the copper deposition, and interestingly, the freshly deposited copper itself can also act as a catalyst, so the reaction keeps going.
Wow. Any downsides?
Well, it generally only produces quite thin films, maybe around a micrometer thick, and the baths themselves are thermodynamically unstable, so you need careful control.
Got it. Thin but uniform and great for insulators. Lastly, what about depositing semiconductors? Can you do that electrochemically?
You can, yeah. Several ways, actually.
Such as?
Well, one indirect way is to deposit a metal film first, then oxidize it later in, say, an oxygen atmosphere.
Okay, deposit, then convert.
Or you can use anodization to form oxide films directly. Another cool way is to use the electrochemical reaction to change the pH right near the surface.
Change the pH?
Yeah, make it more alkaline locally. This causes metal hydroxides to precipitate out, which can then be converted to oxides.
Clever chemistry.
Or for things like metal chalcogenides, sulfides, selenides, you might use chemical deposition, like reacting silver with a sulfur source.
And for really precise stuff?
There's a technique called electrochemical atomic layer epitaxy, or ECALE.
Atomic layer. Sounds precise.
It is. It uses a self-limiting process based on something called underpotential deposition to build the film literally one atomic layer at a time. Incredible control over thickness.
Okay, so we have these methods, but once deposition starts, how do the layers actually grow? It's called electrocrystallization, right?
That's the term, yes. And the very first step is forming that initial thin film of one material on a different material, the workpiece.
What determines how that happens?
Two key things, really. First, the interaction energy. How strongly do the depositing metal atoms stick to the substrate atoms versus how strongly they stick to each other?
Okay, sticking preference.
And second, the crystallographic misfit. How well do the crystal lattices of the two materials line up? Is it a good geometric fit?
Right. And based on those?
We generally see three main growth modes. First is Frank Van der Merwey growth, layer by layer.
Like stacking perfect sheets of atoms.
Pretty much. This happens when the depositing metal really likes the substrate strong interaction and there's very little lattice mismatch. Perfect alignment.
Okay. What else?
Then there's Chansky-Krestanov growth. This is kind of a mix.
How so?
You get an initial perfect monolayer. Like before, but then because there is some lattice mismatch, the strain builds up, so subsequent layers start growing as little three-dimensional islands on top of that first layer.
Ah, islands on a flat layer to relieve the stress.
Exactly. And the third mode is Vollmer-Weber growth. This is 3D island growth right from the start.
When does that happen?
If the depositing metal atoms prefer to stick to each other rather than the substrate, or if there's a big lattice mismatch from the get-go, it just starts forming islands immediately.
This leads us to a really critical concept, nucleation. How do these layers even begin? When does a tiny cluster of atoms become stable enough to grow?
It's all about an energy balance. You've got these individual atoms wandering around on the surface.
Yeah, diffusing.
Occasionally, they bump into each other and form small clusters. But these tiny clusters are unstable. They tend to fall apart again.
Until
they reach a critical size. Beyond that size, the energy balance shifts, and it becomes more favorable for the cluster to grow rather than dissolve.
And what determines that critical size?
It depends heavily on the overpotential. That's the extra electrical driving force you apply.
More driving force.
Means smaller clusters are already stable. A higher overpotential makes it easier for nuclei to form, so you get more of them.
You know, this reminds me of putting a boiling stone in water when you heat it.
How so?
Well, you do that to prevent superheating, right? To stop it suddenly boiling violently. The stone gives the bubbles nucleation sites to form on.
That's a perfect analogy. Yes, just like boiling needs nucleation sites for bubbles, electrodepositions often need sites, maybe defects on the surface, for these metal nuclei to form easily.
So nucleation takes a bit more energy to get started, like boiling.
Generally, yes. It requires a higher energy input, a higher overpotential, than the subsequent growth of those nuclei.
And do all the nuclei form at once?
Not necessarily. We distinguish between two types of kinetics here. Instantaneous nucleation.
All at once.
Pretty much, yeah. All the available sites pop into nuclei very quickly at the beginning. And then there's progressive nucleation.
Gradually.
Right. Nuclei keep forming over time as the deposition continues. And whether it's instantaneous or progressive, that really affects the final structure of the film.
Okay, so nuclei form. They start to grow. How does that turn into a complete solid film?
Well, initially, each nucleus grows kind of on its own. It has its own little hemispherical diffusion zone around it, supplying ions. We call that independent growth.
Each one doing its own thing.
Right. But as more nuclei form, or as the existing ones get bigger, their diffusion zones start to overlap.
They start competing for ions.
Essentially, yes. This leads to interacting growth. The mass transport of ions to the surface becomes less efficient overall because they're sharing the supply. Usually, the total current measured will decrease at this point.
Are there models for this?
Oh, yes. Mathematical models like the Avrami equation help describe how the surface gets covered over time as these nuclei grow and merge.
So the film builds up as these growing islands or layers coalesce. What does the final structure, the microstructure, look like?
It can vary a lot. If you have layer growth, you can get very smooth films, especially if you use low current densities. That's ideal for some applications.
Like optics or electronics.
Exactly. But you can also get growth dominated by surface defects, like screw dislocations. That can lead to spiral growth patterns.
The virals?
Yeah. And sometimes impurities adsorbing on the surface can block growth at step edges, leading to step bunching, where you get macroscopic steps forming.
What about the 3D growth modes?
There, the film becomes continuous when the individual growing crystallites finally bump into each other. Where they meet, they form grain boundaries.
And the overall texture?
It can range quite a bit. You might get rough, field-oriented crystals, sometimes forming whiskers, or you could get very fine-grained, randomly oriented structures, or even columnar grains, where some crystals grow faster upwards than others. There are classification systems, like the Fisher-Wynn system, to describe these microstructures.
This sounds incredibly complex to manage, which brings us to control. How do engineers actually control these processes in the lab and in industry to get the specific structure they need?
Yes, control is key. And one of the most critical parameters is current density.
The amount of current per unit area.
Exactly. It has a profound influence on the microstructure and properties of the metal you deposit.
How so?
Generally, higher current densities tend to favor faster nucleation and smaller grain sizes, but can also lead to rougher deposits or incorporate more impurities or hydrogen. Lower densities often give smoother, denser films with larger grains.
How do you test that quickly?
There are tools like the whole cell. It's designed with specific geometry so that the current density varies across the surface of the test piece.
Oh, so you can see the effect of different current densities all in one experiment.
Precisely. You plate one sample, and you can visually see how the coating quality, brightness, smoothness, burning changes as the current density changes. Very useful for optimizing baths.
But you mentioned current density isn't always uniform on a real part, right?
Correct. That's a huge issue, especially with complex shapes. We talk about current density distributions.
Distributions. Plural.
Yes. There are different levels to consider. First, the primary distribution. This is purely geometric.
Like corners stick out further.
Exactly. It's based only on the ohmic resistance of the electrolyte solution. Areas closer to the counter electrode or sharp points will naturally get more current, while deep recesses get less.
Okay, just geometry and resistance.
Then there's the secondary distribution. This takes into account the kinetics of the reaction itself.
The speed of the electron transfer.
Right. Different areas might have different activation barriers or charge transfer resistances. This can smooth out the primary distribution somewhat.
And the third?
The tertiary distribution. This one is all about mass transport limitations.
Getting the ions to the surface.
Yes. If the reaction is fast, you might deplete the metal ions in those recessed areas faster than diffusion can replenish them. So deposition slows down there, leading to thinner coatings, even if the primary and secondary distributions would suggest otherwise.
Wow. So how do you figure out which distribution is dominant? And more importantly, how do you get a uniform coating?
Well, we use a dimensionless number, the Wagner number, often written as Wa.
Wagner number, okay.
It compares the kinetic resistance from the reaction to the ohmic resistance from the solution. If Wa is very small, ohmic resistance dominates the primary distribution rules. Geometry is key.
And if Wa is large?
Then the reaction kinetics dominate. The secondary distribution becomes much more important, and the coating tends to be more uniform, less dictated by just the shape.
Interesting. You also mentioned side reactions could help.
Sometimes, yes, like hydrogen evolution. If HER happens more readily where the current density is highest, like on points, it consumes some of that current, effectively reducing the current available for metal deposition there.
So it kind of self-corrects?
It can, yes. It can locally reduce the metal deposition rate where it would otherwise be too high, improving overall uniformity.
And this naturally leads to the idea of throwing power, doesn't it?
Exactly. Throwing power is a measure of the ability of a plating bath, the electrolyte solution, to produce a uniform coating thickness even when the primary current distribution is non-uniform.
You want good throwing power, obviously.
Definitely. Especially for complex parts, we differentiate between macro throwing power, how well it coats large features, recesses, and complex shapes.
Right.
And micro throwing power, how well it fills tiny pores, scratches, or levels out microscopic roughness.
And good macro doesn't guarantee good micro.
Not necessarily, no. They depend on different factors. There are specific test cells, like the Herring-Blum cell, used to quantitatively measure throwing power.
How do you achieve high throwing power in practice?
Often by adding specific substances to the bath. Things that increase the solution conductivity help reduce the primary distribution effects. And crucially, adding things that slow down the charge transfer step, increasing the kinetic resistance, generally improves throwing power.
Okay, so steady current has its challenges. What about pulse deposition? Why cycle the current or voltage on and off?
Pulsing gives you another level of control. It can significantly improve coating properties.
How?
Think about it. During the on pulse, you deposit metal. Just like DC plating, a diffusion layer forms where ions get depleted near the surface.
Okay.
But then comes the off time. During this pause, there's no deposition. Ions have time to diffuse back towards the surface, replenishing that depleted layer.
So you reset the concentration for the next pulse.
Exactly. This helps maintain a more uniform ion concentration right at the surface throughout the process. It prevents ions getting starved in certain areas.
What benefits does that give?
It can lead to smoother coatings, finer grain sizes, and help prevent undesirable things like dendrite growth, those spiky tree-like structures.
Can you tailor the pulses?
Oh, yes. You can use rectangular waves, sinusoidal waves, vary the on-time, off-time, peak current.
Yeah.
You can even use very short, high overpotential pulses specifically to create lots of nuclei.
Like a nucleation blast.
Sort of. Get lots of seeds down quickly, then switch to a lower current density pulse for uniform growth on those seeds. Very powerful technique.
And one last control parameter, temperature. How important is that?
Very important. And sometimes overlooked, bath temperature affects almost everything.
Like what?
Higher temperatures generally speed up the deposition rate, of course. They also usually enhance the dissolution of the anode, where the metal comes from. And critically, they improve diffusive mass transport ions move faster.
So hotter is always better.
Not necessarily. There's usually an optimal temperature range for each specific process. Too high, and you might get unwanted side reactions, decomposition of additives, or changes in throwing power, or the coating's properties like internal stress. Careful control is needed.
Okay, we've talked control. Let's get into the bath itself, the chemistry, the secret sauce maybe. What's in these galvanic baths besides just the metal ions?
Right. The basic recipes, you know, acids, salts have been around for a long time, but modern electroplating relies heavily on additives.
Additives, okay.
Take a standard acidic copper bath, for instance. You have copper sulfate as the metal source, but you also have sulfuric acid.
Why the acid?
Several reasons. It provides high ionic conductivity, so current flows easily. It also keeps the pH low, which is crucial to prevent the copper ions from precipitating out as copper hydroxide sludge.
Makes sense. What about complexing agents? When are they used?
These are really essential in certain situations, especially if you're trying to deposit a metal that would normally just precipitate as a hydroxide at the pH you need to work at.
So they keep the metal dissolved.
Exactly. They form soluble complexes with the metal ions. They're also critical when dealing with very reactive or base metals. And crucially, they can shift the equilibrium potential of a metal.
Shift the potential. Why is that useful?
It allows you to co-deposit metals that normally have very different deposition potentials, metals that wouldn't plate out together otherwise.
Like making alloys.
Precisely. The classic example is plating brass, which is copper and zinc. Their standard potentials are quite far apart. But adding cyanide as a complexing agent shifts their deposition potentials much closer together, allowing them to deposit simultaneously as an alloy.
Cyanide. That sounds tricky.
It requires careful handling, absolutely. But it's very effective. This leads us to the really fascinating stuff, though.
The minor ingredients with major effects.
Exactly. Brighteners, levelers, activators, wetting agents, often added in tiny concentrations, parts per million sometimes.
But they have a huge impact on the final coating.
Massive impact. Most of these additives work by absorbing onto the workpiece surface. Usually, they tend to slow down the deposition rate locally.
Slow it down? How does that help?
Take a leveler. The magic here is often that its absorption is controlled by how fast it can diffuse to the surface.
Okay.
So imagine a rough surface. Protruding areas, the peaks, have easier access to the bulk solution. More leveler molecules arrive and absorb there, slowing down metal deposition on the peaks.
And in the valleys.
The valleys are recessed. Diffusion is slower into them. So fewer leveler molecules arrive, meaning deposition isn't slowed down as much, or might even be faster relative to the peaks.
Ah, so the valleys catch up with the peaks. It levels the surface.
Exactly. It equalizes the deposition rate across the microprofile. Brighteners work similarly, often on an even finer scale, interacting with the crystal growth to prevent large crystal formation, leading to those mirror smooth bright finishes, often used in combinations.
So they're literally smoothing things out microscopically. Mm-hmm. What about the others? Wetting agents.
Wetting agents are basically surfactants. They lower the surface tension. This helps the solution wet the surface properly, dislodging any trapped gas bubbles, especially hydrogen bubbles from HRR.
Sobbing bubble pits.
Right. Preventing defects. They also help keep other additives dissolved and can prevent tiny dirt particles from getting stuck on the surface and incorporated into the growing film.
It sounds like there's a lot of know-how involved. Is the science fully understood?
Honestly, for many additives, their precise molecular mechanisms are still debated or rely heavily on empirical knowledge, decades of experience knowing what works. We have theories like relating adsorption to Pearson's hard and soft acids and bases, HSAB principle, which can give qualitative predictions, but it's complex. They really are the secret sauce.
One of the most amazing applications of this additive science has to be superconformal film growth, right?
Yeah.
Especially for electronics.
Oh, absolutely critical. We're talking about filling incredibly tiny, deep features like vias or trenches in microchips and circuit boards. These can have aspect ratios, depth to width, of 10.1 or even more.
And if you don't fill them perfectly?
You get voids, empty spaces inside the connection. That means device failure. Catastrophic for a chip.
So how do additives achieve this superconformal bottom-up fill?
The key mechanism is often referred to as CEAC, curvature enhanced adsorbate coverage.
Curvature enhanced adsorbate coverage. Okay, break that down.
Imagine you have a bath with at least two key additives. One is an inhibitor, let's say polyethylene glycol, PEG. It adsorbs everywhere and slows down copper deposition.
Okay, break.
Then you have an accelerator, maybe something like SPS, bis-3 sulfopropyl disulfide. It also adsorbs, but it speeds up deposition where it is.
A break in an accelerator.
Right. Now picture that deep trench. Initially, both absorb everywhere. Deposition starts slowly. But look at the geometry. As copper deposits, the surface area at the bottom of the trench is actually increasing slightly or changing slowly.
Because it's filling up.
Kind of. But the surface area at the top opening and on the flat surfaces outside the trench is shrinking much faster as deposition occurs there too.
Okay.
The accelerator molecules, the SPS, they tend to stick to the surface. They don't desorb quickly. So as the surface area changes, the concentration of adsorbed SPS increases where the area isn't shrinking fast, i.e. at the bottom of the trench.
It gets concentrated at the bottom because the top surface is disappearing faster.
Precisely. Due to the local surface curvature changes during growth, this higher concentration of accelerator at the bottom makes deposition much faster there. It literally fills from the bottom up, pushing out voids.
That is brilliant. It's like the process optimizes itself based on the shape.
It's an incredibly elegant solution using competitive adsorption and geometry.
Okay, we've done single metals, complex additives. What about depositing mixtures?
Yeah.
Alloy deposition.
Very important. Most metals used in engineering aren't pure, they're alloys. For better corrosion resistance, hardness, magnetic properties, you name it.
But you said plating them together is hard because they have different potentials.
That's the main challenge, yes. If one metal deposits much more easily, is more noble than the other, you'll just get mostly that one metal, not the desired alloy ratio. You need them to deposit at similar rates at the same potential.
So how do you force them to play nice together?
Several strategies. We mentioned complexing agents already. They can shift the potentials closer.
Right, like cyanide for brass.
Or you can operate under conditions where the deposition of the more noble metal is diffusion limited.
Starve of ions.
Basically, yes. Keep its concentration low enough or the current high enough that its deposition rate is limited by how fast its ions can reach the surface. This allows the less noble metal to catch up and co-deposit.
Okay. Any other tricks?
You can use specific additives that selectively inhibit the deposition of the more noble metal, slowing it down just enough.
Target the faster one.
Exactly. And sometimes you rely on induced co-deposition. This is where a metal like, say, tungsten or molybdenum, which you typically cannot deposit from a simple aqueous salt solution on its own.
Can't plate pure tungsten easily?
Not from water, no. But it can be deposited if it's co-deposited along with another metal, usually an iron group metal like nickel or cobalt. The presence of the depositing nickel somehow enables the tungsten to deposit too.
Fascinating. So beyond alloys, you can make even more complex materials. Multi-layers and composites.
Absolutely. Composites are about embedding particles into the metal matrix as it grows.
Like the hard particles you mentioned earlier.
Yes, things like silicon carbide, aluminum oxide, even diamond dust. You suspend them in the bath and they get incorporated into the coating, usually to improve wear resistance or hardness.
And multi-layers.
That's different. There, you're deliberately creating a layered structure, alternating thin films of different compositions.
How do you do that?
Often by rapidly switching the deposition potential back and forth between values that favor deposition of one component versus the other, or by having two different plating baths and moving the substrate between them.
Why make these layered structures?
They can have unique and sometimes amazing properties that neither material has on its own. The classic example is giant magnetoresistance, or GMR.
DMR.
Yeah, alternating layers of magnetic and non-magnetic metals, just nanometers thick. Their electrical resistance changes dramatically depending on an external magnetic field.
Damn.
This discovery won a Nobel Prize and is crucial for modern hard drive read heads. Allows huge data density.
Incredible. Combining materials for totally new functions. Okay, one last area, and this one sounds pretty futuristic. Bipolar electrodes. What are they?
Ah, yes. This is a really cool and rapidly developing area. A bipolar electrode is a piece of conducting material that is not physically wired to the external power supply.
Not connected? Then how does it do anything?
You place it in an electric field that's generated by other electrodes, which are connected. We call them feeder electrodes.
So it just sits in the solution between the powered electrodes?
Exactly. And the electric field in the solution imposes a potential difference across this floating conductor. One end of the bipolar electrode becomes effectively anodic, positive relative to the solution nearby, and the other end becomes effectively cathodic, negative relative to the solution.
So oxidation happens at one end and reduction at the other.
Precisely. Even though there's no wire attached, the reactions are forced by the external field passing through the solution and interacting with the conductor.
So you can make reactions happen on an object just by putting it in the right electric field without touching it. That's amazing.
It is. And it opens up possibilities for doing localized electrochemistry without complex wiring. Really powerful.
What are some applications?
Well, one area is making Janus particles. These are tiny particles, maybe micro or nanometer sized, that are coated differently on opposite sides.
Like the Roman god Janus with two faces.
Exactly. You can use bipolar electrochemistry to plate, say, platinum on one side of a gold particle and nothing on the other. These asymmetric particles can then act as self-propelled microswimmers when placed in a fuel solution, like hydrogen peroxide.
Tiny motors. For what?
potential future applications in targeted drug delivery, environmental remediation, microrobotics. It's an active research area.
What else?
Creating gradient materials. Imagine wanting to test many different alloy compositions for catalytic activity. You can set up a bipolar electrode system to deposit a thin film where the composition gradually changes from one end to the other.
A composition gradient?
Yes. Then you can test the whole range of compositions at once, maybe by seeing how quickly the film dissolves in a certain environment. You can literally read the best composition off the sample like a ruler. High throughput screening.
That saves a ton of time.
Huge amount. It's also used for nanoscale electrochemistry, allowing you to address tiny nanoelectrodes without the incredible difficulty of making reliable wired contact. And there are industrial reactor designs using stacked bipolar electrodes for high efficiency and large-scale processes, too.
Inducing reactions from a distance really changes how you think about electrochemistry.
It really does. As we've seen today, electrochemical deposition, it's just such a vast and intricate field, and it's constantly evolving.
Yeah.
From those simple experiments you might see in school all the way to filling features smaller than viruses in our most advanced electronics, the level of control and understanding just keeps pushing forward.
It really hammers home how these fundamental ideas in physical chemistry, ions, electrons, potentials, surfaces, show up in really surprising and, frankly, essential ways in our everyday technology.
Absolutely. So the next time you admire a shiny chrome finish or, you know, use your smartphone or even think about battery technology, maybe take a second to consider that incredible atomic scale dance of ions and electrons controlled by voltage and chemistry that made it possible.
A nice thought.
But it also raises a question, doesn't it? Given how much of this, especially with the complex additives developed empirically through experience and careful observation, what truly unexpected breakthroughs might still be out there? What happens as our fundamental molecular level understanding gets even deeper? Are there completely new secret sauces, new mechanisms just waiting to be discovered?
What hidden chemistry awaits? Really fascinating thought to leave our listeners with. Thank you so much for sharing all this today.
My pleasure.
And thank you, dear listener, for joining us on this deep dive into electrochemical deposition. We hope you feel a bit more informed and maybe even a little more curious about the amazing chemistry happening all around you, often unseen.